Welcome to Finding Proof, where we discuss all things early stage VC.
We're your hosts, Thanasis and Jenny of the Proof Fund, and our goal is to get to know the best seed and early stage VCs out there. Today, we're speaking with Scott Birnbaum, founding partner of Red Sea Ventures. Red Sea Ventures is an early stage venture firm investing in technology-enabled startups that are building the next generation of products and experiences for consumers and workers. Red Sea Ventures makes seed and Series A investments and is based in New York. Scott, thank you so much for joining us today. We're really looking forward to the conversation and the opportunity to learn more about you and Red Sea Ventures. You have a very interesting background spanning from corporate law and digital media to entrepreneurship. As a starting point, tell us about your journey and what led you to venture capital.
First, thank you both for having me on the show. I really appreciate it. It's an honor and it's exciting to be able to share some time with you guys. My career is a little bit unusual in the sense that I started as an entrepreneur before I became more of a corporate person. And my first real experience as an entrepreneur with venture backing was in the DC area in college during my senior year. And we built a software enterprise platform with a solution that we were selling to law enforcement agencies and intelligence agencies. It was a really complicated business to build in the market, meaning the mid-Atlantic region, the DC area that did not have a ton of venture capital. Although there was a pretty robust tech ecosystem at the time, there wasn't a ton of venture capital or entrepreneurialism. And my co-founder and I found ourselves being really young and starving for mentorship and for people to learn from. And what we found was that a lot of the people working in venture had not been operators, and that a lot of the operators were not angel investing. And there's a little bit of a different era 20 years ago. And so that kind of left me with this impression that there was a real value and a need for entrepreneurs to be surrounded by sources of capital that had built businesses before and could share in that experience, both with skin in the game as well as advisors. And so long story short, after we sold that business, I decided to go back to law school because I had always wanted to do that and I felt like I wasn't sufficiently educated. And so I did that and then weirdly fell into an opportunity to go to White & Case, a big law firm, where they offered me the opportunity to go and live in France for a few months, all expenses paid. And I'd grown up in France. And so it was like a dream opportunity to go back there and be with family again for the first time in 10, 15 years. And I also figured, if I learned the law, I may as well learn what the practice of the law is for a little bit. So I thought I'd start another company coming out of law school. And in fact, had gone pretty far down the road working on a few different pitches and business plans. But this kind of sidetracked me. I did that for a few years, started angel investing a little bit, and then got recruited to go to CBS. And I was there at an interesting time in New York on the digital side of CBS, where I was seeing this second wave, which is what I've been calling it, of tech entrepreneurs in New York. I think the first wave was 99, 2000, big crash, Silicon Alley disappears. It had all been ad tech at the time. It completely gets decimated. And then you start to see a rebirth around 2008, 2009, in the wake of the financial crisis. I think a lot of smart people decided this traditional career role of going into banking or consulting wasn't really for them anymore and started to direct their energy towards wanting to be the next Mark Zuckerberg. And I had a first row seat in watching that new ecosystem of entrepreneurs emerge. One of the deals, and one of my biggest regrets, is that I met the Shopify team in 2012 and wanted to do a deal with CBS. And for a number of different reasons, it didn't work out. I think my biggest mistake was not reaching out to them saying, hey, I'd just like to invest personally. And I think in the wake of that experience and working with some of these entrepreneurs, I realized that New York was going to be a powerhouse for tech domestically, but internationally also for geopolitical reasons, for geography reasons, been working the bridge between Europe and the US. And I thought that there was not a lot of seed-focused venture capital available in New York and that maybe I could build the next platform, the next franchise for it. And yeah. So that's the combination of my disparate experiences, my sort of love of the deal, my love of entrepreneurship, and my desire to be a part of helping people build something from scratch. This was kind of what led me to this.
Definitely. And what was the experience like starting Red Sea and what is the genesis behind the name?
Yeah, I was a theology and government major in college. And what I regret with the naming of the firm is that sometimes people are drawn to think that it's got theological connections or maybe biblical connections, which is true, but thematically, not in the sense that I think I'm a prophet for the venture capital world. The story of the Red Sea and the story of Exodus is really interesting from sociological perspective, because it's really a story of the birth of a new nation and a new societal model. And I think that's what technology is doing. And if we can be a small part of helping to direct that disruptive creative energy towards creating something better for the world, that's a pretty exciting spot to be able to play. So that's where the name loosely comes from. You asked the question of what it's like starting a fund.
Yeah.
So it turns out it's if you have access to capital through investors that are willing to support you, which we had in our first fund from prior relationships through my startup and co-investments, mm-hmm. It turns out it's not that hard to start a fund.
Yeah.
Turns out running a fund is actually a lot of work. And that was like the genesis of my connection to you guys at Proof. Is John Burke had been a relationship, a friend from years prior to that in DC when I was still an entrepreneur. And he had always been really generous with his time and his mentorship on the entrepreneurial side. And when I decided I was going to start the firm, to this day, I don't know how I could ever thank him or how to make sense of the fact that he gave me this kind of time, but he probably spent an hour a week with me for the first 6 months, if not more. He was almost like my investment committee. We'd get together and talk about deals, and he'd give me feedback and help me develop my muscle memory on investment process, and coach me through a lot of questions that I had. It was remarkable, and I'm incredibly appreciative of it. I leaned on him for a lot of that help because it was lonely. I was alone doing this. B, I had never done it before. I'd been an entrepreneur and I'd invested as an angel, but I'd never run a fund. And C, I had no support from an operational perspective. And so it was really a stretching of myself in the sense that I wanted to have really good coverage of what was going on. And so you had to meet a ton of entrepreneurs. I didn't even have an office at the beginning. So I was meeting people in Starbucks or taking calls from my couch in the living room. And it was a real hustle, and it was a fantastic and exciting time. And 2013 in New York was a really exciting time to be investing in tech-enabled businesses. What I like to say, it was a lot of hours, and it still is a lot of hours in ways that I hadn't necessarily anticipated before, but in ways that are super fulfilling.
Tell us a little more about the strategy of the fund and how that has evolved over time.
Our strategy is focused on the consumerization of the economy. So the idea is that the internet and mobile phones and other points of connectivity are really pushing the power of the network out to the edges. And as that happens, you have a whole slew of new opportunities that can change the way the economy works and the way people work and the way people experience everything in their lives. We took an individual-centric view of how technology can impact people. Then what are the downstream effects of that and where are the opportunities? And we take a view that is focused both on the consumer side as well as on the consumerized B2B side, meaning bottom-up SaaS tools that help people in their work lives, whether that's marketplaces or software, that empower them in whatever it is that they're trying to do, even though that may be in their work lives. And because of that, we have a fund that looks a little bit like a generalist fund, although it operates from first principles in terms of the things that we're excited about investing in. Within that, there are four areas that we focus on. Future of work, that's a lot of labor-enabling marketplaces, bottom-up SaaS, new organizational tools and models. The second is commerce. In our first fund, we invested quite a bit in direct-to-consumer brands that worked really well in that first generation, like Allbirds and Sweetgreen and Outdoor Voices, just to name a few, but also a focus on e-commerce-enabling tools, and we continue to do a lot more of that. The third is consumer health, where we're focused on telemedicine and wellness. And the last is future of living, where we focus on food, education, entertainment, and smart connected hardware, a subset of that category. So those are the thematic areas that we're primarily focused on. In terms of the evolution, at the beginning, it was a question of whether we can just identify good deals. And now I'm happy to say we have five companies that are worth over $1 billion from that first iteration. And now that we're investing out of our second fund, we are focused a little bit more on leading deals and on optimizing for portfolio construction, making sure that we can be disciplined around check size and continue to drive great returns, but really hypercharge the returns for our investors, as well as continuing to get into great deals, of course.
And what is a typical check size for you? And is the fund geographically based?
Yeah, about 70% of our portfolio is New York. The remaining is generally West Coast based. We take a little bit of a Groucho Marx approach that if somebody's coming to pitch us, then we shouldn't be a part of that club. And so that's, I think, doubly true on the West Coast. Now, having said that, now with 7 years into doing this and a couple of decades in tech, we do have great relationships of people that may have started in New York or in the DC area and moved out to the West Coast, and people that we've gotten to know along the way, both on the fund side and the operator side. And so sometimes we see great deals that we have access to that we otherwise might not have and make sense. Convoy is a good example of that, a company that's based in Seattle, where we have no network, except that employee number one was a founder that we had backed in a prior company. So New York primarily, US a little bit more broadly, because of the fact that I grew up in France, we also have a pretty robust network of entrepreneurs and also of LPs that have connections all around the world. And so we have one company now that's overseas in the UK, and I suspect we may see some more.
What's your perspective about New York? By many measures, it's like the second largest tech ecosystem now in the US, probably after Silicon Valley. And a friend of mine had the perspective that during the first dot-com, it didn't fare very well because it was all about technology and building the infrastructure. But the second phase of tech evolution has been about the markets, right? And New York has media, has advertising, has finance, fintech, and a lot of others. And so that's why it's done very well, because it's now about, like, how do you disrupt those markets? Do you share that view, or how do you think about what's happening in the city?
100%. The way that we think about it is that 99, 2000 into 2010 or 2007 was really about the development of the infrastructure layer of the digital economy. And now we're in a phase where we're obviously continuing to develop the infrastructure, but we're in the development of the application layer of the digital economy. And the application layer, whether that's finance, insurance, real estate, fashion, you name it, there is a major Fortune 500 globally that is headquartered in New York or has a very significant presence based in New York. That means that you have a lot of talent, people who have grown up in those industries, who are coming out of them, looking to disrupt them with intimate knowledge of what those industries are all about and how they work internally. We're really bullish on New York. There's a lot of criticism of New York, or I shouldn't say criticism, there's a lot of negativity around New York today because of COVID. And for sure, New York, I think, if I'm not mistaken, is the number one most impacted city in the world in terms of COVID numbers. Certainly on the first wave, I'm sure that will change going forward. And so New York was hit really hard. And a lot of people left temporarily, a good number of people left permanently. But there's something pretty magical about the density and the human network effects that New York provides. And there's something to the serendipity of connection that can happen in a place like New York that can't happen on Zoom, that can't happen in a lot of other markets. And you still have the institutional inertia that has existed for decades in New York that I don't think is going away anytime soon. And so while I think New York will have to reinvent certain parts of itself in the wake of COVID, I'm really long this city.
Is there a specific company maybe that you can use that as an example to describe what you're looking for, and maybe tell the story of how you found them and why you're excited about its potential?
Yeah, sure. I think that the challenge is figuring out which one we want to highlight, but maybe one that I'll illustrate from is a company called Air.Inc, which is building a suite of SaaS collaboration tools for creative teams. So if you believe that visual marketing and visual assets are going to become an increasingly important part of corporate communication, which we believe that they are, and the numbers prove that to be true, then you need tools to enable these distributed teams of freelancers and full-time employees and creatives that are working on the development of these assets for a growing number of companies that are using this new language to communicate. And so Air is effectively building a SaaS bottom-up self-serve tool that lets people sign up for the product and use it to collaborate, where you can effectively think of it as a Slack meets Dropbox, where you can load up all of your visual assets, all of your files directly through integrations with Dropbox or Google Drive or whatever other DAM you may be using. They then have built computer vision tools that'll meta tag all of the images and the assets, which supercharges the search process when you're trying to figure out what images to use. And then they've got these project boards that allow you to collaborate, comment on them, modify the images, et cetera, and really bring those teams together in a virtual environment.
What stage is the company in?
We invested at the seed.
And in terms of maybe a more mature company that has grown a bunch since your early investments, what is the one that you are most proud of?
Again, a really tough question to ask which one of them we're most proud of. I think one of the early ones that I'm particularly proud of is Sweetgreen. This is a business that we invested in when they had 4 stores. I had known the founders for years before that through my network as an entrepreneur in the DC area. They were seniors at Georgetown at the time. And their vision early on was to be the quick serve restaurant bringing healthy local food to the masses, albeit at a reasonably elevated price point initially, but with a vision on how to bring that down over time. And the combination of their insight on the consumer behavioral shift towards healthy eating pretty early on in the evolution of that market, plus a new way of thinking about branding and experience in store that was really a millennial-driven shift at the retail level, was really compelling and really hard for a lot of VCs who turned the deal down when they were originally raising. And we were the first fund to invest in their company. We were very honored to have that title early on. And watching what they've done on every level of that business has been nothing short of remarkable. They now have 109 stores across the country. They have weathered COVID really well. They've really been thought leaders in the digitizing of that experience of retail restaurant. About 50% of their business comes off of their mobile app. It's probably higher now with COVID. And it means that they're one of the few restaurant retail businesses that has really granular information on who their customers are, how to reach them, how to re-engage them, how to market to them, how to develop product for them, how to optimize the in-store experience for them in ways that most restaurant businesses, you know, still cannot do today. And so they've really been thought leaders. They've pushed the boundaries of their brand from a four-wall in-store experience out to inside office parks and buildings through their Outpost program, which is a batch delivery program where if you order by a certain hour, then it all gets delivered at the same time. They're really innovating in a lot of different sectors of that business. And I think they will be one of the major platforms over the next 10 years.
So there was an interesting profile on TermSheet today. I'm not sure if you saw it regarding Amazon's pharmacy business and VC's bet on Amazon's ability to serve as, you know, a fertile ground for essentially new consumer-facing businesses. And obviously the flip side of the coin of that is businesses that are direct to consumer. So what's your take on that, if you have one?
I think it is very difficult to plan to build a business on top of Amazon. That doesn't mean that it's impossible, but I think it's very difficult. I think the channel dependency is really scary if you're a direct-to-consumer brand. I think that incentives will not always align with supporting their marketplace participants. And so I think entrepreneurs should tread very carefully in how and when they engage in that platform. Having said that, it's obviously incredibly powerful. The value of their logistics offering alone can be a game changer for a lot of businesses. And so I think you really have to understand your company, your CAC to LTV, how important logistics and shipping is to your unit economics, and figure out where that balance lies and how you end up building on top of relying on Amazon as a channel. Generally speaking, we are not excited about investing in businesses that are that channel dependent, let alone Amazon as a channel.
Yeah, it was interesting reading the news of Heyday's recent funding, which basically it is a company that acquires and incubates companies that sell products on Amazon. And there are other competitors out there too. But no, I think that's a really interesting perspective, especially because you have, you know, such a consumer-facing portfolio.
No, the other thing I'd say is that what we like to invest in on the consumer side is really like culture-defining generational brands. And if we're good at doing that, then those businesses don't need to exist on Amazon because they are the destination. They're not the product. And so given that lens, we're a little bit less interested in gaming the Amazon platform.
Is there a vertical that you're really excited about these days, and what makes you be so excited about it?
Telemedicine is really going to undergo some pretty extraordinary changes over the next few years. COVID obviously has been a massive accelerant, but if I'm not mistaken, I think the percentage of people who have experienced telemedicine went from sub 10% last year to about 49% this year. That is just absolutely astounding. And when you look at a government level, the relaxing of the regulations that have paved the way for that to be able to happen, it's difficult to imagine them rolling back a lot of those changes because the benefits are just so clear. Clear advantages for the consumers, clear advantages for the providers, and clear advantages for the payers, because the faster you can get service to people, the more you can get ahead of higher costs for delayed service. And so I think we're going to see an increasingly accelerated trend towards that. When you layer on top of that connected hardware and broadband and 5G, you can see a lot of other tools being developed on top of these telemedicine platforms. AI obviously is another really big one from a diagnostics perspective. And we think that's a really big area of opportunity. We think there's a huge opportunity in a lot of the niche verticals of telemedicine where you can build, where you can really deliver built for purpose tools for that specific vertical. Obviously, mental health is one of them, but there are subcategories of mental health. We have a company called Monument in the alcohol use disorder space, and we think there are a lot of other verticals to explore there.
For sure. And there, I think it's interesting to look at COVID and how it has affected so many different verticals and how it has pushed the agenda of innovation so far ahead. You can look at the same thing happening in education. You talked about future of work and what that means, meeting remotely and all those kind of things. And I wonder what the long-term impact of that would be.
It's a bit of a strange time for me personally, because I've been thinking, are these themes that we invest behind are all COVID accelerated themes, but obviously we were working on them before COVID. And oftentimes one of the challenges that we had was figuring out the timing of when these visions would come to fruition. One of them that we thought about a lot was a trend that we were calling reverse urbanization or re-ruralization, right? The idea that the cost of living inside large cities was just becoming so unbearable for millennials as they come into adulthood, have families, millennials who have really wanted to stay in cities, but now just find themselves in positions where economically it's untenable to do that. And so the idea was, what does that look like as millennials start to move out? Do they move out to the suburb that's still massively overpriced and now a 45-minute drive away when in reality they could telecommute 3 days a week? So I think that theme has certainly been accelerated and there's opportunities there. But when you layer on top of that changes from a transportation level, and I'm sure you guys saw the Hyperloop announcement that they had their first manned trip a few days ago, you'll be able to go from Philly to New York in 20 minutes with a Hyperloop. Now, it's going to take some time, obviously, for them to lay the pipes to be able to do that. But assuming that they get there, how much does that change your calculus when you've now got tools for remote work that make you super effective? You've got corporate culture that allows and, in fact, embraces it because it's a cost advantage. You now have the ability to travel in to major metropolises for entertainment reasons, for dinner within 20 minutes, or to come to work. That has a pretty significant downstream impact on the organization of cities and the distribution of population. So I think there's a lot of really fast changes coming ahead that have a lot of downstream implications at the consumer level, at the product level, at the work level, at the education, at the telemedicine, really everything.
In another direction, what does next-gen commerce mean to you? And where do you see that going?
On the next-gen commerce side, what we are looking for is a lot of the picks and shovels of developing that industry. There are so many gigantic aspects of the offline retail industry that don't yet exist in the online world for a variety of different reasons, some at the infrastructure level, some just purely at the innovation level. But for example, we invested in a company called Clyde, which is extended warranties for e-commerce retailers. Extended warranties make up a significant portion of profitability for a lot of retailers. And that is a product that has largely not been available to online retailers, both because the UI hadn't been developed for them to be able to integrate it directly into their e-commerce platforms, because the insurers weren't offering products that were appropriate for different types of retailers. And so Clyde is trying to solve that problem. This is a $45 billion industry just in the US. Another example is one of our companies called Jor, which is a marketplace for wholesale, right? So whether you're a brand doing apparel, which historically was sold in showrooms or at trade shows, now you've got online tools that allow you to build an e-com-like experience of wholesale trading that gets used by large department stores, but also more broadly, every small retailer can now use that without having to travel to Paris to go to Fashion Week in order to make their buys, or to New York Fashion Week or whatever.
Been following that company for a while, actually, and I love the concept of it.
It's incredibly empowering. I mean, it's to small business owners that are constrained and because of their capital constraints can't get access to the same products, and now they really can. So yeah, no, those are two examples of where we think there are opportunities on the financing side, on the distribution side, on the logistics side. Really, the pipes of that digital commerce economy still have yet to be laid.
That's great to hear your perspective on that. So talk to us a little bit about your investment criteria. What do you look for and what distinguishes a really great investment opportunity for you?
From an investment perspective, I mean, for one, it obviously starts with the founder. We want people that are remarkable and ideally have demonstrated the fact that they've been remarkable in a number of different areas in their lives. If for nothing else, that at least demonstrates their commitment to working hard in order to get to that point of being remarkable in that particular area. One of the questions that we ask ourselves, is this somebody that we would like to work for ourselves? And then we also ask ourselves, do we think that this person has the ability to run an organization with hundreds of employees? It's not easy to answer that question when they may be young and first-time entrepreneurs. But there oftentimes is something that you see in them that makes you believe that it's possible. So that's about the entrepreneur. Depending on the markets that they're in, we'd like them to have experience within that market. But sometimes they don't need any. From a business evaluation perspective, we're looking for very large markets. Although again, sometimes we're looking for large markets that are tough to quantify. And so sometimes we have to rely a little bit on imagination and intuition. And so in that regard, we're looking for founders who also have a pretty unique viewpoint on why they think a market is changing and why this opportunity will exist at scale. Beyond that, and this is an important piece for us, which I think anybody who looks at our portfolio will probably see it, even though we don't necessarily call it out, is that we're looking for founders that are mission-driven, people who are building companies that we think can have some positive impact on society. If it's a company like Sweetgreen with bringing healthy food to a broader audience, or it's Allbirds that's designing sustainable materials for footwear, or it's Casetext, which is an example of a company that's building software for solo practitioners, lawyers that are solo practitioners to get them better tools. We're always looking for companies and founders that are motivated to have a positive impact. And we think that's an advantage. That's not just a kind of double bottom line perspective. We think that is an advantage for recruiting, for marketing, for sales, and ultimately for acquisition. We are believers in a move towards the stakeholder economy, and we think that corporate acquirers and investors will place an increasingly large premium on businesses that are mission-driven.
So at this point, let's flip to the standard questions that we ask everybody just in an attempt to get to know you. So question one is, if you could have a magic wand and change or improve something in the VC industry, what would it be and why?
I would want to see a platform to help emerging VCs gain access faster to the information that they need. As I mentioned earlier on, John Burke served as a pretty meaningful accelerant for me. And so one of the things that I committed to doing is we built this event series for emerging GPs where we bring them in and we have conversations with people like John, but also a lot of other incredible speakers. And the idea is to increase access to mentorship, to apprenticeship, relationships, network development, and information. And I think that a lot of the good that will come out of this industry will come by empowering more small micro investors to identify and pick and support founders working on important problems. And I think it's really hard to do that if the dollars and the knowledge continue to be concentrated in a handful of very large platforms.
Got it. Question two, if you were not a VC investor and money was not a concern, what career would you have?
So there's two that I think about often. I don't know if this would be a career, but as I mentioned earlier, I grew up in France. And so bread and pastries is a really big part of my life. And it saddens me that I find it so difficult to get great bread and pastries here. One of the things that I've always liked doing, but I've really leaned into with COVID is baking at home, baking and pastry making. I find a lot of joy in doing that. It's just like a great release for me. And so I wonder if that's not something that I would enjoy really going into if I could do absolutely anything that I'd like to do.
What's your favorite thing to bake?
I've got a lot of different ones, but I really enjoy making chocolate croissants, pain au chocolat. It's like a hard to make.
That is talent because that is not easy to make. Or I'm just totally assuming because I actually have never tried.
Yeah.
But it looks like it would be difficult.
It takes a lot of trial and error to get it right. But it's really fun and really satisfying when you've got that for breakfast.
They're so good.
The other thing that I'm really passionate about, which I think is why I do VC, is I have a really big interest in leadership development. Outside of my venture role, I've been a volunteer for and a member of the board for a nonprofit called Seeds of Peace for the last 15 years. And they're a leadership development organization focused on youth in conflict regions. It's been really amazing to be able to work with now close to 8,000 youth that have graduated from the program and watch them develop and give them the tools to be able to do that into adulthood. And so I think that's probably an area that I would spend a lot more time on if I weren't doing this.
That's great. And I can definitely second you on the lack of pastry shops in the U.S. as somebody who comes from another Mediterranean country. It was a shock to me.
Yeah, I was so excited. Maison Kaiser, I don't know if they have them down in D.C., but when they opened here, I was so excited. It's actually really good French quality bread and pastries. And then the pandemic shut them down. They went bankrupt and it's over.
Oh,
it's a real bummer for me.
Question number three is, who is someone you look up to and why?
One of the people that's become a mentor for me over the last few years is a gentleman named Strauss Zelnick, who's the chairman and CEO of Take-Two Interactive, a public company in the gaming space. He also runs a private equity platform called ZMC Capital that he founded. He was one of the youngest studio heads in Hollywood, like in his 30s. And in addition to that, he's somebody who is really family oriented and has managed to, despite his insane schedule and the fact that he has multiple careers running at the same time, really makes time for his family. And not only for his family, but for himself too. He's like an insane fitness buff. His ability to balance all of those things at once and be successful at so many of them has been really inspiring and doubly inspiring because in spite of all those things, he also takes the time to mentor people like me, but a lot of others. And his mentorship has been really impactful on a business level, on a personal level. And he's one of the people that I have a lot of admiration for.
That's great. And final question, what is the best piece of advice you've ever received?
That I needed to go build a venture platform. I'm too early on in my career to say whether I will end up being really successful doing this or not, but I can't imagine doing anything else. I can't imagine finding a career that's more fulfilling and helps me achieve my objectives better than this does. And there were a couple of conversations that I had early on where I was thinking about this, but felt ill-equipped to do it for lack of experience and lack of knowledge. And these two people in particular, one who ended up being my first commitment as an LP, and another one who was a VC who at the time was at SoftBank, a guy named Joe Medved. And both of them sat down with me and said, you absolutely need to do this. This makes all the sense in the world and you should go and do it. And do not let concern or fear stand in your way. That's been a really meaningful thing for me.
That's terrific.
Scott, thank you so much for joining us today. We really enjoyed the conversation and we're looking forward to continuing to work together in the future.
Thank you both. Same here. And thanks for having me.
And follow us on Twitter @ProofVC or on our website @proof.vc.